found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show, heard live every weekday morning on LATalkRadio.com. It is Tuesday, June 4th. Thank you so much for joining us. And then we're on iTunes, and later on our website, you may download on demand. And we were having a problem with the site yesterday. The MariaSanchezShow.com site, GoDaddy, apparently was having problems. And as of early this morning, it was still ongoing. So sorry for that. You can also go to themariasanchezshow.com, and that is another way to get to the podcast. It says click for today's podcast, but it has the history of all the podcasts. That'll take you to the latalkradio.com archives as well. And we thank you so much for your emails. We thank you so much for your suggestions. We try and follow through on everything that you suggest that we look into. We respond to each and every one of your emails. You can get our email contact information on all those places. So just if there's anything that you want to comment on or you have a complaint about or there's something that you'd like us to do some research into, we're happy to do it. And that's actually been providing some of the content of the program. We describe the program as people, when they ask, they say, what is it about? And I say, we do something that I have called personality radio. Current events, newsmakers, lifestyle, health, relationships, fun things to do, interesting anecdotes, and a coterie and a stable of correspondents who visit with us as their field of expertise is in the news. So, for example, tomorrow we have our medical correspondent visiting with us. He's on a rampage, if you will, to stop nutritional child abuse. He is very polarizing with his opinions. He's very opinionated, and for that I really enjoy our conversations. He is not only a medical doctor, he's also an attorney, and he's out of Chicago. And a little later in this program, we're going to have our Word of the Month correspondent, who's Peter Sokolowski. He's the editor-at-large of Merriam-Webster.com. He meets with us at the beginning of every month to talk about the most searched words that happened the month prior. And he mentions why some of those words were in the news and why people were looking to find out what the definition of the word meant. And it kind of gets you a pulse of what we're thinking about. With 1.5 billion hits a year, it's not a small sample. So the math is like 100 million hits a month or something. So, and I always enjoy our conversations. Man, is he a Renaissance man and intelligent and articulate and bright and engaging and personable. So he's coming up in just a little bit. News of the day. This morning, Queen Elizabeth celebrated the 60th anniversary of her coronation with a service at Westminster Abbey. She had on the crown, the St. Edward's crown, which was made for the coronation of Charles II in 1661. It's decorated with rubies, sapphires, amethysts, and it's been used to crown every British monarch since. Today, this morning, marked the first time it has left the Tower of London since her coronation in 1953. 2,000 people were at the Westminster Abbey this morning to celebrate, including Prince Charles and Camilla, as well as Prince William and his wife, Kate. They say that she's never going to step down. She'll never abdicate. She's made that clear. She talks about her duties. She is now 87 years of age. Her husband, Prince Philip, is 91. Talk about longevity. And the service this morning had hymns, prayers, a reading from Prime Minister David Cameron, and a poem written for the occasion by poet laureate Carol Ann Duffy. Last night there was a reception, and Buckingham Palace said that Prince Philip didn't attend because he was unwell, but they did not elaborate, and the prince was there with her this morning. Last night there was a reception at St. James Palace, and it featured performances by the opera group El Divo, which, if memory serves me correctly, which is kind of a scary thing these days. I am around so many people who are, where it takes three of us to finish a conversation because it's like, you remember when the, and then we finally get to the thing. But I believe El Divo is a group that Simon Cowell created, that he cast for all over the world. And I was a huge fan of theirs. Their singing is just fabulous, and they're obviously still performing. So some troubling news today is that numbers released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show a dramatic spike in suicides among middle-aged people, with the highest increases among men in their 50s, whose rate went up by nearly 50%, and as well as women in their early 60s, whose rate rose by nearly 60%. The highest rates were among white and Native American and Alaska men, and in recent years, deaths by suicide has surpassed deaths by motor vehicle crashes. And they're saying it's a trend among baby boomers whose suicide rates have shot up precipitously between 1999 and 2010. Now, a lot of it, they say, could be attributed to the recent economic downturn, because financial recessions in general are associated with an uptick in suicides. But the boomer trend started a decade before the 2008 recession. So psychologists and scholars are saying it stems from a myriad of issues, particularly devoted to a generation who vowed not to trust anyone older than 30 and who rocked out to lyrics such as, "I hope I die before I get old." They're saying that boomers are reluctant to accept the realities of aging. And since boomers have been a youth-oriented generation, we're not digging the fact that growing up and growing mature comes with maladies, it comes with health issues, it comes with realizing that maybe our lives haven't turned out the way we thought they would or they should. Maybe it comes from, you think that when you get to this stage of life that you'd be able to sit back on your laurels and actually enjoy the fruits of your labor, and the truth is that we might not ever be able to retire based on the economics. So drilling down on that story from the Centers for Disease Control is a more troubling one. In the state of Kentucky, they're saying at least a dozen lawyers in Kentucky have committed suicide since 2010. Half died in the last 12 months. All were men. Their average age was 53, and most were trial attorneys. So studies show that lawyers are six times more likely to kill themselves than the general population. And so Kentucky is going to be looking into this, and their bar association, even their lawyer assistance program, offers confidential help to help attorneys with depression. So thinking that, okay, we're going to take this sad story and maybe spin just a little bit, wanted to pass on foods to boost your moods, and this is according to Health Magazine, walnuts and asparagus. So walnuts have tryptophan in it, and that helps create serotonin, and asparagus has folate in it, and that helps with the creation of dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine. So take that for what it's worth. And serotonin, I didn't really know much about serotonin. I've heard it's the feel good hormone or amino acid or whatever it is. And when I was married to my ex, I used to really be a Pollyanna. The glass was always full. And when I went to college, my two best friends were guys, and they used to say that the rainbow ended where Maria was raised, and the rainbow ended where Maria lives, because I was always fairly ebullient, and that's okay, it'll work out, and I just never thought about the alternative. Now life has kicked me to the curb many times, and I would say I'm more seasoned, but I would still say that I'm fairly happy-go-lucky. So fast forward to my most recent ex-marriage, my most recent past marriage, not a statement I'm proud to make, and my ex was the opposite of that. He was kind of a doomy, gloomy, kind of curmudgeonly kind of guy, which was an interesting match. And he said to me one day, "You have an inordinate amount of serotonin in your system." And I was like, "Yep, sucks to me. So big deal. What's the problem in that?" So that's when I got to know more about serotonin. So a few more stories that are in the news this morning, and then we will get to more of them after our chat with Peter Sokolowski, is a Colorado judge is expected to rule today on whether to accept a not guilty by reason of insanity plea from the alleged theater gunman James Holmes, who faces execution if he's convicted of killing the 12 folks in the theater last summer. So Arapahoe County District Judge Carlos Samore Jr. had delayed the ruling on the matter until legal issues surrounding the plea were resolved, and that's supposed to be today. Prosecutors are seeking the death penalty for the former University of Colorado Denver graduate student if he's convicted. But the public defender said that since he has been incarcerated twice, he has been hospitalized, once for apparent self-inflicted head injuries, and again when he was held in restraints in a psychiatric ward. So we're going to call Peter now, and we will have the chat. He's going to also talk to us about the history of the spelling bee, and then last week's spelling bee, where I'm going to tease him about being a rock star there.
You have reached Merriam-Webster. Our business hours are 8 a.m. to...
We always try and get people on landline so there's better reception.
Hello?
Hi, Peter. It's Maria Sanchez. You're live on the air. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to hear your voice.
As always, you always put a smile on my face. So, Peter, I've introduced you, but I'll do it again. Editor-at-large with Merriam-Webster.com, and it serves as a pronouncer for spelling bees around the world, as well as a lecturer on language. So thank you for taking the time to visit with us and our listeners. Before we get into May's words, the searches that were the most dominant, tell us about the last week's spelling bee as well as the history of the spelling bee, please. And where does that curious term spelling bee originate?
Right. I mean, it's a great American tradition, of course, the spelling bee. And we just had it last week, as you know. And it goes back in America, of course, it goes back all the way to before we were a nation. It goes back to the days of colonial America. Benjamin Franklin himself thought that a spelling challenge or having students quiz each other in spelling was a great way to learn spelling. But if we go all the way back, the first reference, the first evidence we have of a spelling competition is from Shakespeare's time, which is kind of exciting when you think that we go all the way back to that period of the Elizabethan England in the late 1590s. And there was a textbook, a school book, that depicted two boys who quizzed each other, and they asked each other different questions about how to spell words, and so they would try to best each other in that way. And they would ask each other questions about the patterns and the rules of English spelling. They would say, for example, why is there a silent E in this word, or why does this word start, you know, why does it start with a J and not a G? And sometimes the answer was an answer we're all familiar with. Sometimes the answer was, well, because it's spelled that way in the list in the back of the book.
because I said so.
Because I said so. But as it turns out, that list, that very list from the back of that very book, which was called An English Schoolmaster from 1596, that list was the list that was taken, and just a few years later, a few words of definitions were added and a few other words were added to make what became the very first monolingual dictionary of English. And so what we have is the first evidence of a spelling competition and the original source of the first monolingual dictionary of English in the same slim 80-page Elizabethan volume. And I think that's remarkable that the notion of contests of spelling goes back all the way to the very origins of the dictionary itself.
And why do you think that, I mean, I know why spelling is important, but it's, to me, it's about being civilized and paying attention to traditions and rules and that sort of thing, because I'm old-fashioned in that regard. But now with the texting and how everyone uses the letter U for the word Y-O-U, and, you know, all the acronyms that talk to you later, so that talk to you, you know, that sort of thing, it seems to not matter to people. I'm still grammatically correct in my emails and in my texts, which I get ribbed about. But so what do you think, why then? Why was it important then?
Well, what was especially important then was a couple things at the same time, because if you know your Shakespeare, spelling wasn't entirely settled even in Shakespeare's time, because he would spell certain words in different ways. But the important invention at that time was the printing press, just about 100 years earlier. And so now, all of a sudden, you had a real sort of public and a mass kind of communication and a way to make printed matter available to many, many people. So you had a rise in literacy. You had a corresponding rise in what you might call today the middle class. And all of a sudden, printers needed to look certain words up. They needed, they wanted a kind of standardization of spelling. And it really actually was from the world, the professional world of printers, people who were interested in selling books and selling what we might call magazines or newsletters today. And they were the people who were advocates of more regular spelling because they needed a kind of a system that hadn't existed before that. When you think about it, everything had been handwritten up to that point.
So what's also interesting is that when we separated from the UK, they continued to spell words, and we spell words differently than they do, and yet we're speaking the English language.
So, exactly. And that was a deliberate, that's connected to the B also in its way, because what happened was Noah Webster, who was a great patriot, he, of course, made the first American dictionary, and he changed the spellings. That's why we have American English today that is recognizably different from British English, and by that, you know, I refer to those spellings that you're talking about. For example, color and honor and humor, we drop the U. A word like civilization, we spell with a Z, but a British person would spell with an S. Words like plow, P-L-O-U-G-H, were simplified. So that was all Noah Webster's doing, but his book, his first book was not a dictionary, but a spelling textbook. And that became not only the textbook for generations of Americans, but also the rule book for spelling bees, because they would use the list, again, the list in the back of that book to challenge each other. Think of the pioneers who were moving west in the late 1700s and the early 1800s. They often didn't have teachers, but they had this textbook, and they would use it to teach their children and also to quiz them.
So is Noah Webster is responsible for the American English language spelling single-handedly?
Yes, it really is a remarkable thing.
Wow.
In fact, without question, he has to be regarded as the single greatest spelling reformer in the history of the English language, because that's a really hard thing to do, to change the course of a language and to make words, you know, to change the spellings, the standard spellings of a language. And it's partly because he chose his moment so well. He chose that moment right after the American Revolution, when all of a sudden American printers and publishers no longer looked to London for styling and spelling. And also, London publications would be brought over by ship. And all of a sudden, all of that stopped, and American printers had to fend for themselves. And so they looked to the American reference, which was Noah Webster's dictionary.
Now, spelling bees, I can remember I was in the sixth grade, and because I went to the Catholic schools who were really big on grammar and diagramming sentences and all that sort of thing, and I don't know if in public schools they did it, but we had them a lot. And I remember to this day the word that I didn't know how to spell that I lost out in being the top. I made the top 10 one day, and then there were two students that had been sick, so they had us, the 12 of us, then compete for the next top 10, which I think is really unfair. So I was one of the ones that fell. So the pressure, I can't imagine when you're talking about last week's national spelling bee with a $30,000 prize, how, and these kids are young, what, they're 4 to 14, or, I mean, 8 to 14?
Yeah, about 8 was the youngest this year, I think, and 14 or 8th grade is the oldest you can be. So a lot of the spellers, for example, the winner was 13. Not only that, they're on ESPN, they're on live TV,
right.
And so they have an enormous amount of pressure. Most of them are kind of like Olympic athletes. You know, they have really trained for this. You saw a little bit of nerves and a little bit of jitters, but mostly you saw them. You saw their own personalities, and that's what's so great. But these are kids. The winner, I believe, studied 6 hours a day on weekdays, school days, and more on the weekends to win.
My.
And as I said, these are kind of the Olympic athletes of spelling.
And you mentioned when we spoke last month that there was something unique about this spelling bee, and you want to share that with the listeners?
About the Scripps spelling bee?
Yes. Because for the first time they had the vocabulary.
Oh, right, of course, right. This year they added, there are preliminaries where there is a written exam, and what the spellers do is, in groups, they go in and they put headphones on, they actually listen to the words pronounced, and they spell them, so it's a spelling test at a computer. But this year they added a second part to that test, which was a vocabulary test. So, much like you might see on a standardized test, there will be a word, and four choices as to its meaning. And it's not really about defining a word specifically, but it's more like knowing that, for example, a pterodactyl was a dinosaur, mm-hmm. and not a type of a rock, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So they just make sure that you have some kind of general knowledge to locate where and what that word means. And this does mean that you're bringing the dictionary sort of even closer to the spelling bee. I think of the spelling bee as the purest possible use of the dictionary, because we're just citing the words as words. We're not even using them to carry meaning.
And then, so this happened last week, the spelling bee,
mm-hmm.
and you were there for it, and on Monday, a week ago, you actually addressed the spellers and their parents. Can you tell us what you spoke about?
Sure. A lot about this history of the spelling bee, that connecting the early, the Elizabethan school teaching manual with competitive spelling, which is exactly what is depicted there, and then bringing that history up into the 17th century in England, where it's depicted elsewhere, and then into the 18th century in America, where, as I said, not only did Ben Franklin recommend it, but there are accounts of school competitions, and in fact, if you were the losing team, you would have to sweep up and make the fire the next day in New England. And also what happened was the spelling bee moved from the classroom to the town hall and became an evening entertainment that would involve adults as well. This was, of course, a great entertainment at a time before electricity and movies and anything else. So,
mm-hmm.
in fact, it became kind of a nationwide craze in the period right after the Civil War, and there was a novel that depicted a great spelling bee, and people loved it, and so Mark Twain wrote about spelling bees, and so it just became a great kind of local activity, not just for kids. The one that we know as the Scripps Spelling Bee, the National Spelling Bee in Washington, began in 1925 and has been going on every year since.
And how is it that the money that's awarded, where does that come from? Do you know? I was
staggered. The Scripps company used to be called Scripps Howard, and they are a wonderful media company. They own a lot of television affiliate stations around the country,
mm-hmm.
and they still own a lot of newspapers.
Yes.
And they really believe in this activity. They really believe that this is a good national sort of event every year. And so they sponsor the finals, and the spellers are all sponsored by individual radio, television, or news. Newspaper outlets around the country, so that the sponsors pay for the young speller to go to Washington and compete after that speller has won his or her regional or statewide bee. So it's kind of a combination of local funding and one big national funding at the end.
Now, I read something that of those that get sent to Washington, there actually was a pool of about $11 million that started initially.
Right. I know. When you think of every young speller, every student in every, say, public school, grade school, there might be a school bee and then maybe a regional bee for that little region, or just competing with their neighboring school. But then the winner of that one will go on to, say, a bigger event or a bigger region, and ultimately get to the statewide bee. And so what you have is the beginning starts with every classroom, you know, that participates, which
mm-hmm.
is a huge number, 11 million. And then you bring it down to the statewide level, and then once you get to the national level, we had 281 spellers this year attend the bee, and the finals were only, I believe, 11 in the finals, 11 or 12. So it really does weed out all of the contenders.
Now, there was another story too about the last like six were all of Asian orientation but born in America, and like the last 9 out of 14 were as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's not uncommon, of course, anymore. The South Asians, especially Indians, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, children of those nationalities have done enormously well, especially in the last 20 years. You see them winning, it seems, almost every year. And, you know, who knows? There's all kinds of cultural generalizations we can make. And I think generalizations are just that. You know, they don't answer what, any specific case, but you see great study habits and lots of parental support for sure.
So was there any surprises that you saw when you were there? And by the way, I shared with the listeners after we exchanged emails last week that you were asked for your autograph during the week because you're the rock star in that world.
Yeah, well, these kids, they live with the dictionary. For them, they know the dictionary better than almost anyone else. And as you said, I give a talk on, it's really the first event of Bee Week on Monday morning. I give a dictionary lecture, and this year we discussed the history of the bee, but we also really discussed the history of the dictionary, and we talked about Noah Webster and Samuel Johnson, and especially about Webster's Third, the unabridged dictionary that they use to study, because the rules say that the words have to come from that dictionary.
It's a big
14-pound dictionary that is published by Merriam-Webster, and it has 470,000 words defined in it. And so we really talk about that. And then for the rest of the week, I talk about the dictionary to the parents, and I give the award at the banquet to the winner. So I'm involved at the Bee all week, and yes, the kids, they have little books with a page for each speller, and they often ask the pronouncers and myself, they ask us to sign those books as well.
How sweet is that?
And oh, it's fun.
Yeah, I bet. And how great for you, too, because this is the roundhouse of you, and then you get these young people who have, you know, are gazing adoringly at you. I think it's a win-win-win in that regard. So let's segue to Merriam-Webster.com. Give a brief overview, please, and how often and how many people come to you, and then we'll drill down to May's words.
Right. The website is our dictionary. It's based on our collegiate dictionary, which we put online for free in 1996, and some people thought we were crazy to do that, but what we decided at the time was that we thought people would really want to find a dictionary online that they could trust. And then, as now, if you have to pay for it, there's a lot of resistance. So we felt that maybe making it available for free would be a good idea. And it turns out that that was a good idea. We have about 1.5 billion, with a B, page views per year on the website. And that gives us a new way of measuring the English language, because we now know which words are being looked up in what quantities and when. So, for example, during the Boston Marathon bombings or during the presidential elections, we can trace what words are being looked up. And it's really great fun. I report on those lookups, as we call them, on Twitter. That's one way to follow in real time. But also every week we put something called Trend Watch, which is what we can talk about now. And the week's best word, or that is to say the week's most looked up word, and starting in May, we had, going back to the first week of May, it was a funny little Latin phrase, Ditat Deus. And it's the Latin phrase for God in riches. And do you know where that came from?
Not at all.
Yeah, it was looked up by many, many people because it's on the Great Seal of the state of Arizona. And it was because of the Jody Arias murder trial on television. And the seal of the courtroom, which is the seal of the state, was visible on TV. And many people looked that up. And isn't that amazing? But those Latin words, Ditat Deus, God in riches, is what it means. It drew a lot of attention. It really showed you a little bit about what people were thinking about, but also what draws people's what draws people to the dictionary. The following week, we had the word androgynous, and that came from the actress in the Star Trek films, whose name escapes me at the moment. What's her name?
I can't help you. I'm not a Trekkie.
Yes, she plays Lieutenant Uhura in the new films, and the new movie just came out, as you know. Mm-hmm. And in a big famous interview in Allure magazine, she called herself androgynous, and what she meant, she was referring to the fact that she may well have a domestic life and a child with a woman. Or with a man. She was sort of saying she was open to both, and she used the term androgynous to describe herself, and that was a word that was looked up a lot during that week.
But that wouldn't be the right description. Wouldn't you say she misused it?
I think that you have a really good case.
Yeah, I think that's not what that means.
To say, because there's a big difference between bisexual
right.
and androgynous. And androgynous simply means having the qualities of both sexes,
mm-hmm.
Which could mean a short haircut, for example.
Right. Or lanky and, and lithe, or, you know, not necessarily well endowed, or...
Exactly. And androgynous often refers to an appearance of, and in the case of this particular woman, she there's nothing masculine about her appearance. So the fact is, I agree with you that I think she kind of picked a $5 word, and it really didn't suit that particular moment for her. And so then the next word, the following week, which is to say the week before last, was privilege. And this was because of the IRS hearings in Congress. And one of the officials from the IRS invoked her Fifth Amendment privilege to not testify about her involvement in what is suspected to be an irregular scrutiny for certain groups that were applying for IRS tax-free status. So because the word privilege was used in a legal way, even though it's a word that's fairly common,
mm-hmm.
It was used in this very specific way. And we've seen this before. For example, when Congress punishes a member, they often use the term admonish. And again, that's a word that's fairly common, but when it's used in a very legalistic or specific way, it gets looked up in the dictionary. And then finally, last week, our trend watch was for the word canadel, which was the winning word for the spelling bee, K-N-A-I-D-E-L, canadel, which is basically a matzo ball in soup, or it's a dumpling, and the word comes from a German-derived Yiddish word, and it's interesting that that particular speller, he is South Asian in terms of ancestry, but he actually lives in New York City, which is probably the canadal capital of America.
And I had heard about the word, and I thought the origin was German, and he made some comment about that, because I think he came in second place the last 2 years over
other
German words.
That's right. I don't remember the words, but this is an interesting young man. He finished in third place 2 years in a row, and then he won this year. So if you take his batting average at the National Spelling Bee, I don't think you'll ever find a better speller. In other words, someone who finished in the top three years is really amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true. He was defeated by German-derived words in both of the last 2 years, and in this year, what did he get? And I have to emphasize, these are partly luck. I mean, there's no way that this was predictable, but he was indeed given another German-derived word. This is the Yiddish language, of course, spoken all over Central and Eastern Europe, and this particular word comes from German, and it went through Yiddish and into English from Yiddish. That's why we have sort of a stop along the way.
Now, I've got a German word story that is in the news today, excuse me, ironically enough, but before I share that with you, is I was on my Gmail account this morning emailing about a guest, and I said, so y'all set aside the time, just strategize form amongst yourselves and let me know what will work, and strategize was underlined as I had misspelled it, so I clicked on it, and it gave me strategic, strategy, and something else. So I was like, well, really, is it not a word? So I go to Merriam-Webster.com, I enter in strategize, and it puts it out there just as I had spelled it and as I intended it. So I'm curious about spell checking within the various systems on the internet, which I default to. Do you know what they use or what their software has?
I don't. I mean, it's obviously a smaller dictionary. It's too small if it doesn't include strategize, which is a pretty common word for adults, and it's a perfectly good word. You know, there have been studies made that show that even confident spellers such as you are sometimes misled by spell check because, you know, in this case, spell check is wrong.
Right.
That you spelled it correctly and it's a real word. And so it's important to do as you did, which is to double check and to make sure that the way you spelled it is correct, but also it's possible that you have outsmarted the spell checker. And that's often true, that we're often very susceptible to suggestion by spell check for grammar or for spelling, by the way. And sometimes they're wrong. And in this case, I would just guess that whatever dictionary is loaded, it's just too small.
Mm-hmm.
It should have words like this in it.
But you'd think Google is behind Gmail.
I know. Well, tell them to call us.
Actually, I'm going to pursue this. This is the kind of thing that I get delight in. It's like, can't you at least
put strategy? Well, it's an interesting question.
You know, and Peter, would you let our listeners know, too, that the words that you just went through for May don't include, there are other words that are commonly researched that you don't talk about because they happen month after month after month, like affect, effect, those signs. So are there like six pairs of those that are normal ones, that principal, capital, that
yeah.
kind of thing?
Yeah, well, those, what we might call them confusables, those words, which includes affect and effect, which are among the most looked up words in English. And that's absolutely right. We might call them evergreen words or constant words that are looked up, and they don't indicate anything about the news or the news of the day or any kind of current thoughts, but simply they reflect the fact that the English language is difficult, and people do use the dictionary to check out their spellings. And so, for example, on any given day, you'll see words like paradigm and conundrum and ubiquitous and integrity. Lately, the word pragmatic and the word esoteric and the word conscientious. So those are all words that are looked up quite a lot. I noticed the word supersede is very high, and I think that's a spelling issue because that's a really tough word to spell. People always wonder whether that's a C or an S, and of course there is a little asterisk there because the C spelling is permissible as a variant, but most people expect.
Really?
Yeah. which is true for a lot of English words that, well, like the American English versus British English spellings, you know, that we treat them as variants. So they're officially correct because they do appear in some printed forms. So yes, those words you can also see on our homepage if you just go to Merriam-Webster.com. We do present the words most looked up for the last day and the last week and the last month. So you can see which words are trending on a kind of a bigger scale.
Now, what I've noticed just in my time on this planet is that there seems to be words that are mispronounced and perhaps even misspelled that have become generally acceptable. And the one that comes to mind is verbiage. And most people always say verbiage.
Right.
And now I believe I've seen it in your dictionary as an alternate. I can't swear to that. Because
I can check.
Because verbiage, that's what I use, and then everyone around me is using verbiage. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say it with the I in it. And so I'm wondering, does it become a part of our lexicon if it becomes acceptable in general?
Yes, I mean we acknowledge that there is a pronunciation of verbiage. We do not allow for another spelling of it.
Okay.
But you know that what you just described is in fact a plausible scenario this happens all the time. Usually we don't notice, but you notice this one. And that's somehow the way, that's the way that the language changes. I mean, for example, the word apron in English comes from the French word nap, and nap, which means a cloth. But at a certain point, because you say a nap, get a nap, go get a nap, and it becomes an apron. Do you see? So it was actually just, separating the first letter because of the sound of the word. Change the spelling of the word. There's another example, the word umpire and the word nonpareil, nonpareil meaning without equal. Well, umpire also etymologically means without equal, but you notice umpire doesn't have an N to begin its spelling as nonpareil does, even though they're parallel in etymology. And again, that's because over time the N broke off with the noun marker. So this is an evolution, and I try to look at this without judgment. However, verbiage is the correct spelling, and it is the preferred pronunciation, and you will be judged. People are judged by their language all the time. Mm-hmm. We all know this, that if you spell something wrong on a resume, that's really bad news. And so we should pay attention and we should be careful. And you're correct. You've noticed something that's in transition, I would say. Keep watching it.
And well, and I don't mean to sound like a snob, but to me, the language is beautiful. And when people butcher it, it's like fingernails on a chalkboard.
Sure.
So that's why it stands out to me. I don't say anything, although no. I did have a girlfriend use it, and she's a public information officer like I am, and she used verbiage about four times, and I finally said to her, Julie, I need to tell you something. That's really not the acceptable way to say it. If you're going to keep using it, may I suggest that you know, I tried to be as delicate as possible and to help her professionally, because if other people,
sure,
you know, might judge her, I didn't want her to come up short just for that one word.
And it's absolutely true. We're all judged. Just think of the political figures or public figures whose language is scrutinized in a lesser way. That happens to all of us whether we're speaking in public or speaking in a meeting or speaking at dinner. We do make judgments, and we do sometimes those judgments are very harsh, actually, about certain pet peeves that we might have about, for example, nuclear or library. There's certain kinds of pronunciations. So it always pays to pay attention, and you're exactly right about that.
So my one last statement to you is, do you ever stop words from being in existence once they have been on your radar? Because Germany just did that. Their longest word, which is a 63-letter long word, has officially ceased to exist, and that was in the news this morning. And they spelled it out, and they even had, like you have at Merriam-Webster, where you click to have it went on and on and on. I was like, I didn't think it was going to take that. It felt like several seconds to get the word out.
I know.
My question is to you is, do you do that, or is it once it's in there, it's always in there?
Well, to a certain extent, because our collegiate dictionary is really the current active vocabulary of American English, some words are not active anymore, and they don't qualify. So words are removed from the dictionary, but that doesn't mean that they're gone forever, because if they're written in literature of the 16th century, they will live forever in those books and in our older dictionaries, but we don't mind taking words out if they're no longer in active current use. But we aren't an official body. We don't have, like, the French Academy or the Spanish Royal Academy. We don't have an official body to make these pronouncements. So really just kind of we go by usage, and when you think about it, that's actually the tradition for the English language-speaking world. In Great Britain, there is no written constitution for their government. Everything is based upon precedent. Everything is based upon tradition. That's the way the English language is governed. The English language is governed according to precedent and tradition. So, for example, if it's traditional to spell verbiage with an I and pronounce it that way, that's the correct way.
Okay. And then what about something finally? There's regardless. And then I hear people say irregardless.
Yeah. And that one, I mean, that's clearly just a little, I think, a crossed wire in someone's mind that it you might call it a hyper-correction or a blend of irrespective and irrespective and regardless. These two words that are somewhat close semantically and somewhat close lexically. They do sort of resemble each other. And so I look at that as a hyper-correction or crossed wires. We do enter it in our dictionary because it frequently does show up in print. However, at that entry, if you look it up, it says, use regardless instead.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for your time. As always, it's just a distinct pleasure to chat with you, and I look forward to next month's visit as well.
Oh, it's a treat to hear you. Thanks so much, Maria.
You're welcome. Thank you, Peter, for your time. Have a great day. Peter Sokolowski, editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster.com. And as I said, I really hope that I don't come across as a word snob. I'd happen to love them. They have a great thing on on their site. It's Test Your Vocabulary Quiz now, and it gives you 10 words. And the longer you take to answer, the lower your score, even if you get the word right. And then they have other words that are weighted for more points because they are more difficult. And I play that every now and then. I might say I play that fairly often. But so you can tell, and then you can tweet your score. So I've done that too. It's like, okay, Maria, you know, you should get a life. But anyway, it's one of my passions. I just happen to love words. I find our language just fascinating. And if you can describe something in a more dimensional, relatable way, why not, instead of saying pretty and beautiful, you know, luscious or, you know, what have you, so exquisite. So I am a boomer, and I am fortunate that I have my parents with me on this planet Earth. They've been married 58 years. They are 80 and 83. My dad will be 84 next month. And they have been world travelers. They've done very well for themselves. They speak English as their second language. My dad is the first generation. His folks came through Ellis Island. My mother was raised in a Spanish household in the state of New Mexico, which is the only state of the union that has two official languages. And both of them did not learn English until they went to the first grade. And their English is excellent. You would not know that they are not native speakers. That's how well they speak, and they're still both bilingual. And they came from nothing and made quite a life for themselves. I've often said if I had that kind of success, I would have gone from what they exposed me to being Donald Trump. So they are, let's see, financially secure. I wouldn't say that they're multimillionaires, but they're well-to-do. There's nothing that they can't take care of in that regard. So that's also a wonderful luxury, because I know there are others who parents turn to them because they haven't planned well, or the circumstances are such that they need help or they need support. And my siblings and I have three siblings, a sister and two brothers. We won't have to deal with that. So both of my parents are also suffering from cancer. My mother had her right breast removed 6 years ago and has had nothing but complications, nothing but troubles. It's been just a horrible ride to witness and to participate in with her, as she has just had one malady, one complication, one side effect after another, going, including as recently as last week. My dad has been recovering from malignant melanoma for about 12 years now. So that's the good news. He's still up, you know, and so it went from the top of his head to now last year, November, it surfaced in both of his shins. So he had radiation therapy last fall. He was done with it right before Thanksgiving, so my folks and my brother Carlos were able to join me and my four children for Thanksgiving and for Christmas this year, which was great, because when my dad's doing his treatments, he has to stay where they are because he's there on a daily basis. So the radiation treatments burned the skin off of his shins, and those wounds didn't heal. So this year, calendar year, he's been dealing with the aftermath of that. Finally, it was involving hyperbaric chamber visits 2 hours a day. This has been going on for months. So he was towards the end. I think he only has maybe 3 or 4 weeks left. He's been doing it for months. And we visited with Dr. Willa something, I forget her name, from the Amen Clinics, and she was talking about brain traumas and strokes and diabetes and that sort of thing. And she was mentioning the hyperbaric chambers are doing good things for that, memory loss. So I said to my dad, here's the good news. You're getting residual benefits from your time in the hyperbaric chamber to help with that. So yesterday was no exception. He got dressed to go to his two-hour hyperbaric chamber procedure, where you have to strip naked. You can't go in. It's 100% oxygen, and you can't go in with anything but the hospital gown on you. So watches are off, cell phones are away, etc. Because of the malignant melanoma on the top of his head and the chemo and radiation that he did subsequent to that, it went into the right part of his brain. They over-medicated, if you will, and he's having strokes on the left side of his body in his leg and foot. So my mom doesn't want him to drive, and he insists on driving because it's not his right leg. And so she doesn't go with him to the hyperbaric visits except for every Wednesday, when they undo the wounds. So fast forward to yesterday afternoon, he's getting out of the hyperbaric chamber. He needs a little assistance with getting his shorts on, and the man who normally does that for him is not there, and there's a gal there, so he doesn't ask her for help, and his foot gets stuck in the shorts, he slips, he falls. He has now broken his femur, a spiral fracture. He landed on his head, and he clipped his elbow. So he's in intensive care because they did CAT scan MRI and he's got bleeding on the brain, so they can't operate on the spiral fracture until they get that taken care of. So that's the latest in the saga of what's going on. And if you're a boomer, we're called the sandwich generation because we're taking care of our parents and taking care of our children. And I only share that with you not to complain, other than to share that this is going on throughout our lives. And hopefully, it's like my dad can't catch a break, so hopefully he will. It's Father's Day coming up. In fact, I just ordered his present yesterday to be shipped. Because I might not be able to be with him, which I ordinarily am. Thank you so much for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show. Have a fabulous day, and we look forward to visiting with you tomorrow morning. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.